Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, memory prices are dropping, and now the GPUs are cheap again. NVIDIA debuts a budget GTX 1050, 7-nanometer iPhone A12 processors this year. Qualcomm's building a CPU just for VR. And where are the AMD Raven Ridge updates? All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 467, recorded on May 24th, 2018. Memory prices are dropping, people. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most engaging, most informative, and occasionally most ridiculous news in PC, console, mobile, desktop, handheld, Internet of Stuff news. Today, however, we have something strange and slightly wonderful or terrifying. We have, now that GPUs are once again affordable, practically at MSRPs, possibly even in the near future to be below MSRP as the cryptocurrency world or the cryptocurrency mining community kind of thrashes about wondering when Bitcoin will spike again. We have NVIDIA, ladies and gentlemen, delivering something I really never expected to see and not entirely sure why we need one, a 3-gigabyte GTX 1050 for budget gamers. That nestles in between the sort of GTX 1050 and the GTX 1050 Ti. This seems awesome for 1080p gamers with exactly that amount of money. Not particularly useful for anybody with 1080p monitor that may be going to a higher resolution monitor in the relatively near future. What's the pricing on this like? Does anybody have benchmarks for it? Because they
it's an interesting product, and this is kind of what happens. We've seen this pattern.
Interesting product.
we've seen this pattern a couple times from NVIDIA and AMD in the past. When you're kind of at the tail end of a product generation, that at least in the low end part of the segment, the lower cost segment. You tend to find a reshuffling of things that occur because, you know, you've got this company, they're making a bunch of chips, they've made a bunch of product. They realize, okay, you know, we see in a 6-month window that this is going to be an EOL. Maybe we need to start selling more of this product that we have built up and kind of segmenting it out a little bit differently if it helps. So the GTX 1050 3-gigabyte that didn't exist mm-hmm. before, there was a 2-gigabyte model and then there was a 4-gigabyte 1050 Ti that both still exist. And this fits between them in some cases, but it's ahead of the 1050 Ti in some cases. Like if you look at the clock speeds, its clock speed is 100 megahertz faster on its base clock. Or the 1050 3-gig than the 1050 Ti. The peak theoretical compute, that TFLOPS measurement, the teraflops measurement, is actually higher on the 1050 3-gig than the 1050 Ti. But you do have 3 gigs memory instead of 4, and your memory bandwidth is lower by a considerable margin, probably, you know, 30% or something like that, because you drop from 128-bit memory bus to a 96-bit memory bus. And it's been a long time since I've seen anything under 128-bit memory bus on any of these products. Now, it does have a $160 price point, which airs it more towards the 1050 Ti 2-gig than the 1050 Ti, but it still has a 75-watt TDP, meaning it doesn't need an external power connection. And I believe looking at specs, not having any of these cards in my hand, that there will be some instances in which the performance of the 1050 3-gig will actually be better than the 1050 Ti. Because of that clock speed advantage. So even though the memory bandwidth, peak memory bandwidth is lower on the 1050 3-gig part, it's depending on where that game is bottlenecked, memory or compute, I think you'll see that advantage, you know, go back and forth. And it goes up against the AMD RX 560 kind of equal pricing segment. My guess is that NVIDIA probably looked at this. They saw the competitive space, the 1050 Ti and the 1050 2-gig. The 1050 Ti was about the same performance, but it was a little bit more expensive. So is it easier to drop that price, or is it easier to just kind of shuffle in this new part towards the end? And I think it mostly falls in there. And this is also that segment of the market where literally a rebate here or there, $10 here or there, suddenly changes that comparison pretty dramatically. And it's really hard to do really accurate performance, you know, per dollar measurements that are consistent over a longer period of time because of those kind of frequent price changes. So this to me is not indicative of anybody being desperate for anything, or NVIDIA feeling like it's losing market share or anything like that. It's really a, well, we have this batch of chips that maybe the memory controller wasn't up to snuff, and they can make it a 96-bit instead of a 128-bit. You know, maybe that gives them access to 25,000 additional chips, pieces of silicon that they can sell, and they can get it on the market and get it through these partners. I mean, it's 1080p or below gaming. It's esports gaming. You know, your League of Legends, your Counter-Strike, your Dota 2, those class of games. This is not what you're going to play Far Cry 5 on, probably. It'll be interesting. I've reached out to a couple of people to see if anybody wanted to send one. Nobody expressed an extreme amount of interest in getting it done. I think because probably when you evaluate it at performance levels, it's going to actually confuse things a little bit. So.
Sounds like a card to avoid.
No, I mean, if you're a $200 or sub $200 card, it may actually be a good card, right? Like,
okay,
it may be better than the 1050 Ti. If you can get it for $30 less than the 1050 Ti, and it offers close to the same performance level, maybe even a little bit above it in some random cases, then it might be worth looking at. Or might be the better solution of those. But mm-hmm. it just makes it a little bit more confusing. Maybe right. We'll get them in. We have 1050s, we have 1050 Ti, so now we can sandwich this guy in between. But as is always the case with you know, budget priced graphics cards, the differences in performance between them tends to be very small and minute. And it's not until you jump up from 1060 to 1070 that you start to see sizable gaps that, in right. my view at least, are warranting enough of like really careful consideration of what your budget is. So
many thoughts, none of which will be useful. Okay. So better than the 2 GB 1050 TX, probably, I don't know. It's okay. If you're gaming at anything higher than 1080, I would say get a 1060 as your minimum.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, probably if you're going to 25x14, you probably want 1070 class performance or above. But 10, you know, for 1080p, the 1060 6 GB card is probably going to be my card of choice in that family. Because when you get below that, you're going to start looking at having to scale back on your image quality settings, not just easily hit the very high button and move on with your life. Which is not, it doesn't make it a, it's not a big deal. It's easy enough mm-hmm. to do to change the settings in these games, but it's just something where when you get below 1060, it's probably because you have a cost sensitive build
sure.
that you're focusing on, as opposed to like, give me whatever is good enough for 1080p, which I would consider right. to be the 1060 series.
Yeah. But I mean, you're looking at a $150 jump at MSRP between the 1060 and the 1070. Right. But yeah, a huge jump in performance too. Just yep. buy the most expensive cards you can buy, up to $600, and that yell at fair. Us later.
Yeah.
I don't know. The memory bandwidth on that was kind of freaking me out on that GTX 1050 3 GB.
I mean, it's low. Don't get me wrong. It's low, but I don't know. So, I mean, it's actually lower than the 1050 as well, the 2 GB mm-hmm. card. And yeah. But it does have a gig more memory. So it's a really confusing thing. In graphics card, you know, when you're speccing out a GPU, it's always a balance of, you know, how much pixel processing do I need? How much geometry processing? How much texture processing? How much memory bandwidth do I need? And the more games come out, the more profiles that NVIDIA can look at and how many games they can profile with. They go, as it turns out, we can get away with a little bit less memory bandwidth because the people mm-hmm. who are gaming on this aren't playing Far Cry 5. And those are the ones that have the higher resolution textures, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just I don't think they're putting out a game or a card that's suddenly going to change that paradigm much, that they're going to somehow screw up the balancing act.
I just want to see what the numbers for that look like versus the 1050 Ti. I'm very curious. If they're really good, maybe that's why they're launching it so quietly. because they don't want to cannibalize 1050 Ti sales. I don't know. It is curious. Yeah. Also curious, Bloomberg has a nice write-up on the next generation iPhone chips that are going into production. We've talked recently about Intel's issues with scaling down to the 7-nanometer process, or I should say the 10-nanometer process. But it looks like Apple's working with TSC, or Taiwan Semiconductor, to start launching or start building, constructing the A12 chips that are going to power the next generation iPhone. 7-nanometer design, which of course means, and I quote, smaller, faster, and more efficient than the 10-nanometer chips in current Apple devices like the iPhone 8 and iPhone 10. You know, and then of course they're like, don't identify us because Apple will crush us like grapes, even if we are TSMC and making their processors. So I'll be very curious to see how this rolls out. It seems to me that this is a big deal that TSMC, and we talked about this when we talked about the Intel pushing out a processor that was supposed to go out 2 years ago, another year. It fascinates me that you know, they're pushing down to 7-nanometers while Intel's kind of stalled. I'm also very curious to see if it scales, if it works, if they ship on time, the Qualcomm's doing the same thing. It's curious to me to see the technology on the ARM-based processors or the process that, you know, the ARM-based processors are built on getting ahead of Intel. That kind of blows my mind.
You're not the only one. There are a significant portion of us that are, I wouldn't say surprised anymore, because it was being telegraphed over the last, 18, 24 months, but still, shocked that it would come to pass. I think what's interesting here is that in theory, not necessarily guaranteed, but in theory, Apple starting production on its next SoC tells us that the maturity level of the 7-nanometer process tech at TSMC is at a certain point, right? Mm-hmm. Not that Apple isn't absolutely willing to pay more for more wafers than if the, yield rate is low or something like that. But it's a good sign for everybody else that's going to be using that process, whether it be AMD for GPUs or, Qualcomm for its next Snapdragon part or whatever, that the biggest customer is actively using it now. And it's a good sign.
Yeah, a very good sign for them. While we're talking about processors that you may covet that are coming out this year, it looks like Qualcomm's going to be unveiling a chipset dedicated to VR and AR headsets. At this point, we've basically seen, in terms of the Oculus Rift and Lenovo Mirage Solo, we've seen what amounts to phone processors being used for this, and apparently Qualcomm's ready to create a dedicated chip for VR and augmented reality headsets, which I think is interesting. One, because it's Qualcomm, and two, because Qualcomm kind of left their Android watch partners in the lurch, while Apple's kept pushing forward with the advancements in the hardware and their processors for their watches. Kind of the entire Android community has been stalled if they've been trying to use Qualcomm parts for that, because there has been a new part out there. Possibly next week, Augmented World Expo in Santa Clara, California. It's not a lot of specifics, which I'm not entirely surprised about, but essentially, a part that is dedicated to AR rigs may have different or improved graphics, different ways of handling pixels, having additional sensors on board for, I would hope, 6 degrees of freedom in the skull movements or the tracking. I would love to, I will be curious. I'm very, very curious to see what happens with these next generation headsets and these next generation parts that are going to go into it. I don't even think we have a really good launch date. For some reason, I thought it was this year, but it looks like they're announcing it. We don't know when the actual system on a chip will be. So,
yeah, it's interesting. The question will be, how much different is it than a normal like Snapdragon mobile SoC? What features may it remove to save costs or add performance? There are a lot of questions around what this is, but it makes sense. I think it will, if it comes to pass this way, will lessen confusion at least somewhat, right?
Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, graphics processor, what Bloomberg's saying is the Snapdragon XR1 is going to include graphics, security, of course, the main processing, components to, quote, handle artificial intelligence tasks, voice control. And then I think the big one that makes this the XR one is going to be head tracking interaction with headsets. Who knows? Maybe we'll see a giant collection of $150, Google Dream headsets next year with micro SD card slots. That would be nice.
Sure.
Alan did the write-up for this one. Intel Micron jointly announced QLC NAND flash 96-layer 3D development. Higher densities from 3D NAND. this is considerably denser than 64-layer 3D QLC NAND. Do we have an idea of when this stuff's going to ship and where it's going to be targeted first?
No, I don't. I don't actually know that. There's two separate announcements here. One is the QLC part, and the other is the 96-layer part. So the first rounds of QLC will ship with 64-layer, right? So we're moving from TLC to QLC, which is basically 4 bits per cell instead of 3 bits per cell of TLC, instead of 2 bits per cell in MLC and 1 bit per cell in SLC. So you're getting a 33% bump in capacity per cell, right, on these designs. And then once you move from 64 to 96, you'll get another 50% bump in capacity per die on these chips as well. Now, QLC is interesting in that with every kind of successive generation, you lose a little bit on the sustainability of the writes. As we went, TLC was slower than MLC, which is slower than SLC. QLC is going to be slower than TLC in terms of writes. So I'm curious to see what these vendors integrate in terms of SLC caches or dynamic caches or what they're going to do to kind of modify the designs for this. And then what that does for the longevity of the devices. I still don't think that SSD, mean time before failure is really something that the general consumer needs to worry about at any capacity. In the server space, in the data center, it's a totally different thing. I don't think QLC is going to be that product for write intensive data center workloads. It would probably wear out significantly quicker than, TLC or MLC and definitely SLC. But for the consumer, it's probably going to be fine, especially if these drives have some dedicated portion of SLC and they can spread out the writes from the SLC out to the QLC memory on there over time, or just more evenly distributing it so that the wear leveling occurs on a kind of an equal basis. The 96 layer stuff is I'm trying to see if there was any kind of time frame for that, and I'm not seeing anything. I don't know, but I don't think it's this year. Would be my maybe it is. Maybe it is supposed to be this year. So it's 64-layer QLC and then 96-layer TLC technologies. So you won't kind of be combining both of these, but both equate to creating new families, new groups, new performance segments of solid-state drives, which still trying to get down to that magical 10 cents per gig milestone. I think we did come across an SSD last night on our podcast, the Micron 1100. Which is a bare bones part. I believe you can get the 2 terabyte model for around $280, $300, which puts it in like 13, 14 cents per gig. So we're getting there. We're getting close. I would consider that 10-cent class SSDs if we're going to steal terminology and marketing from televisions and displays. So we're getting there. Yeah, always round down. We're always round in the direction that makes you look better, I guess.
That's very kind of you.
Yeah.
It's very thoughtful of you.
Only because I want it to be true.
It seems perfectly reasonable. BIOS updates on motherboards have always been exciting. Sometimes they enable features that were broken from the factory. Sometimes they add features that were supposed to ship from the factory. Sometimes they make broken motherboards work. And sometimes they deliver performance boosts. It is definitely worth taking a look. If you've been wondering about Ryzen performance or Ryzen 2 performance on Ryzen 2000 performance on some of Asus's ROG motherboards, the crew at KitGuru did a pretty deep review of the ROG Crosshair 7 Hero, and it's pretty crazy. They loved all the features. They loved the ever so stylish, you know, sort of Gundam inspired design, or you know, weird swirly angular black stuff that comes on so many motherboards these days with chromium ish accents. But the performance wasn't so sweet. They ended up getting a new BIOS, which delivered excellent performance, sucking down an extra 40 watts of power in the process. But it turned out you could manually clock it, get the same performance, but without the extra power draw, which gets into an interesting explanation of synchronous and asynchronous mode, how they deliver, and as Jeremy writes, how this relates to the extra power draw. Because in synchronous mode, the CPU memory and PCIe, quote, share all the same clock signal, while in asynchronous mode, the CPU clock can be adjusted without any effect on the memory or PCI clocks. You know, it is unfortunate that a motherboard shipped without the best possible performance from the factory, but it's nice. You know, it's nice to see that, you know, an update can deliver the addition. It kind of always surprises me whether we're talking about, you know, AMD or NVIDIA GPU drivers optimizing for new games or firmware updates, how much performance can be tweaked by people paying attention to the firmware.
Right.
So it's an interesting, you know, they write deep stuff. They do good testing. It's an interesting read, especially if you want to understand a little bit more about how the motherboard and the processor work together. While we're talking about that, you guys had a good write-up on the Raven Ridge desktop APU processors getting a new graphics update, the first driver update for the Raven Ridge APUs that launched back in February. It seemed to me that there was not a particularly significant bump in performance.
No, I mean, the single tests we kind of looked at were the FireStrike 3. Just did a quick 3D Mark test just to see if there was anything. And it was about a 5% improvement in that. And to be fair, that's an already very highly optimized application. Seeing improvements that, you know, big swings and improvements there would be confusing, I guess I would say. The more important thing is that it is the first driver update since the release back in February. And a lot of games have come out since then. And you would assume that since it's basically based on the same the current Radeon Software Adrenaline Edition release, that you get any of the optimizations for those games now moved over into your laptop as well, which is obviously a fantastic thing to have as these new games get released. You know, Far Cry 5, you want to be able to have all that in there. That being said, the fact that we had to wait from February to almost the end of May, mid-May, to get one of these driver releases is kind of disappointing.
Yeah,
because it is an AMD Radeon part, right? It's got Vega in it. You expect these updates to happen, and NVIDIA has proven that you can do that, right? It maybe takes a little bit of pressure and force on your OEM partners. Yes, you must allow our driver to work. AMD appears to have that because you can still get the driver from them. You don't have to like go to your HP OEM driver download website to get it, but they need to be a little bit more aggressive on driver releases for this, I would say.
I really admired how gently Ken spanked AMD in that last paragraph. You know, they must work harder to unify the graphics drivers of their APU products into the mainstream graphics driver releases if they want those products to be taken seriously as gaming options. And
yeah,
you know, the AMD Raven Ridge stuff that shipped mobile in November still hasn't had a driver update. Now, you could argue that perhaps there's a driver update now that's being qualified by HP and any other vendors that are delivering it. But again, man, you know, yeah. I have a lot of admiration for what AMD's doing. But, you know, I was just saying like 2 minutes ago, it's amazing the performance that can be released with a driver update for a new game. And we got nada.
Especially considering the promises, at least, well, I haven't seen the execution yet, but the promises that Intel has made for its Kaby Lake G parts, where they would be releasing drivers for that platform more regularly than they ever have before, because it's using, again, a Radeon graphics solution on there. So if Intel actually ends up beating them at that game, that's pretty much unacceptable, right? So. Mm-hmm.
It makes me sad. Oh, man. Orders for DRAM fell noticeably in April. This is good, right? All right. The AsianNikkei.com has the big write-up on this one. Don't get too excited. The Nikkei Asian Review, I'm sorry. AsianNikkei.com being the website for the Nikkei Asian Review. But basically, as cryptocurrency grinds to its pre-crazy GPU price levels, one of the things that's turned out is memory sales are dipping. I like how they put this. Smartphone manufacturers, data centers, and cryptocurrency miners are the three pillars of the memory chip market. Apparently, desktop CPUs or desktop processors, excuse me, desktops don't actually deserve to be mentioned in there. But as the mining market grinds to slows down considerably, it looks like DRAM prices are going to fall. Quote, orders for DRAMs fell noticeably in April. We previously received quite a lot of orders, as a representative at a Tokyo electronics parts trader. But it seems to be falling off. So, This is interesting, because everybody's been thinking about like, oh, should I buy used GPUs? Because you got like 7 GPUs on a motherboard, but maybe if you've got a metric ton of RAM on all those motherboards, RAM could be a compelling used purchase if you're feeling kind of crazy.
This is good news for everybody except those who make the memory. And in probably even including, you know, the memory, you know, the DIMM manufacturers, the resellers like Corsair or Kingston or whatever, they've been able to charge pretty high prices for memory. Now, what I don't know is if they have been scaling their margins the same way, or have they been taking the same amount of profit per kit sold, or have they been increasing along with it? And it's impossible to know for sure. They would never tell you one way or the other. But it has been such a long time. This
right.
goes hand in hand for the most part with the graphics card side of things, that it's been such a long time since we've seen memory prices go down. I almost don't know what it's going to look like when it comes back down. I have to kind of go back and look at some memory pricing data and see where it started at before it continued, before it began this kind of meteoric rise.
I went feral, nerdy. Back when I was realizing my $800 PC had a current retail value of $2,200 around December or January, I also took a look at memory prices, because one of the things that shocked me was that memory had effectively doubled. And I just dropped a link into the show notes looking at Corsair Vengeance LPX, it's a 16 gigabyte stick, DDR4 DRAM, and it was at the bottom, you know, you were looking at $80 for a 16 gigabyte stick. That was like April, May, I'm guessing June, late June, early July last year. And then it peaked in December at $220 or $218.98. And now it's down 10% between basically March and now, maybe late April, right, early March and now. So it's, you know, that's selling for $200. So still in excess of 2x. It's kind of, you know, if you say that it was selling for somewhere between $80 and $100 or $90 between, you know, May and July, August, maybe September of 2017, you know, you're still looking at close to 2x, in excess of 2x that price, but 20% down in 6 weeks is not something to sniff at in my world.
No, for sure.
You know, you're still looking. I mean, it's also, you know, shopping around is definitely worth it, because looking at like Corsair Vengeance LPX, which I've got in a whole bunch of systems, you know, that peaked at $210 for several minutes in February or March. But again, that, you know, last, you know, 27, this time 2017, you know, those were selling, you know, that was two sticks of 8 gigabyte RAM selling for $80, as low as, I think it hit a sale in May last year at like $60. You know,
good old days.
The good old days. But yeah, again, in excess of 2x its price, even now that it's kind of dropped in the last few weeks. So,
yeah.
You know, and I will also say, if you're like, well, Corsair is a premium brand. Well, yeah, I love Corsair memory. I bought a lot of it out of my own pocket. But the Bob's House of Memory brands are pretty much tracking with those prices. So just something to be concerned about. Asus unveils pricing and availability for PG27UQ HDR-enabled G-Sync display, which is not FreeSync 2 and not the next generation of G-Sync, which we talked about for several minutes, or 2 minutes maybe, in Tech Thing this week, because we had a new FreeSync display we'll talk about in a second. This one really surprises me in a good way, because they are claiming BASIS certified display HDR 1000, which is pretty badass, because, you know, I talked about a Dell monitor a few weeks ago that had a larger color gamut, HDR color gamut, than most of the many of the monitors, maybe even most of the monitors, television sets shipped in 2017. And now we're looking at a monitor that probably has a larger color gamut than the vast majority of monitors shipped in 2017, and is going to be brighter at 1,000 nits. Now that's peak value, right? You were talking about that, but this I was kind of fascinated by this. You know, they're using quantum dot technology. You know, it's 43 inches and 1,000 nits. This is going to be a thunderously bright monitor during explosions. 97% DCI P3, 99% Adobe RGB, which is, you know, not nearly as impressive as 97% DCI P3. $2,000 late June 2018. Not an inexpensive desktop monitor, and a fascinating gaming desktop. I mean, from an aesthetic, scroll back up to the picture of the monitor, if you could. This is one of those products that you are either going to be, there you go. How about that base? Incorporating elements from a mock industrial diamond. No, it's like a weird mixture of a gear or a grinding sort of, you know, the bits they use for digging oil wells. Like, it's just a very strange aesthetic there at the base. There's a lot of, it's like copper gear sweeping legs with a giant.
It's been their ROG branding for a little while, the visual style. And I agree, you either hate it or you love it. But I think even if you don't like it, it's just, you know, you're staring at the picture on the monitor for the most time anyway. But everything needs to be considered when you're looking at a $2,000 display, which, by the way, I don't think we've even talked about, is a G-Sync monitor. It is a 4K 144 hertz panel, right? So it'll do 144 hertz over DisplayPort VRR at 4K. And this is not a TN panel, guys. This is this is the high quality IPS stuff. Or is it VA? I can't remember now. Oh, it's IPS. So it's kind of the first for a lot of things. Like I don't think we've seen a 4K 144 hertz panel in IPS, especially. And now HDR, not just HDR, because we've had several HDR branded monitors in here that are not very good HDR monitors. This with the Display HDR 1000 certification is going to be a very good monitor. And I think I've even been told it's going to have another certification on under its belt as well when it actually ships. So I this is the monitor. If you go all the way back to January 2017 in CES when they first showed these, NVIDIA first showed these at their booth, and I think Asus had one as well. I said, this is the monitor I want. This is the monitor I want. And I, you know, the fortunate thing for them is nothing has really come out to supersede this. This is still the monitor I want. Am I willing to pay $2,000 for it? Woof, I don't know. That's the pretty hard pill to swallow, but it is. It's not just the first G-Sync HDR. It's the first 144 4K IPS. So that there are enough new technologies here to make it a really interesting decision at the very least. And there's also, I don't think I had the notes in here, but there's Acer monitor, the Acer Predator. I forget what the model number of it is specifically, but a similar. It's a G-Sync HDR 4K 144. It was for pre-sale. It was listed for sale in Newegg for $19.99, same price as well. And I don't remember seeing it having any VESA certification like Display HDR 1000 or whatever. So I'm curious to see. My assumption has been that these are using the same panels,
right?
And I believe that's the case. So is Asus getting the first run? Are they doing, you know, manual tuning and calibration on these? And is Acer not? You know, what allows one to get certified and the other to not? I'm going to be very curious to compare these two displays in that regard. And even then, a lot of people don't understand that panel quality is much like chip quality. There's variance in the production. So even if Asus gets the top 20 or 30% of the panels that ship out, you know, there's a chance that some of the Acers that get shipped to media or reviewers, whatever, are going to be the top-notch quality ones as well, even though it may not be the best overall or average of it, too. So there's a lot to pay attention with here, considering this is our first go-around with high-quality HDR displays. Have you used any of the HDR displays yet? Not TVs, but monitors themselves.
One of the Dell 27 UltraThin S, that's VESA 400 certified. You know, one of Robert's concerns about these is the VESA rating is, you know, peak brightness or momentary brightness, not sustained brightness. That makes him a little uptight.
And it's odd that it's an instant. They call it, I think it's instantaneous burst at that peak. You know, Display HDR 1000, so 1,000 nits,
right?
For a burst, but then it's 10% of the screen sustained at 1,000 nits as well, I think.
Yeah, it's very, as Robert put it, quote, I want to see the wording on that VESA spec, because it seems, I'm frustrated because I like the idea of VESA having a spec, and I like the idea because, you know, I want to say starting a year ago, I really became aware of you know, HDR being bandied about in terms of monitor marketing materials, you know, especially in cases where there was no actual HDR content or no way to get HDR content that was available onto the screen. HDR availability is certainly increasing, and HDR gaming, I think, is going to go in interesting places. But, you know, my loose understanding is that, you know, Windows doesn't really do HDR. HDR is done by, you know, Windows will have the kind of spec for the monitor you've attached to your system, and then it allows the applications to control the relationship between the GPU and the HDR monitor. I'm in a learning phase on this one, and hopefully I can get some responses right from some people who are smarter than I am that engineer at Microsoft. But you know, this is a lot of these, you know, this is a wonderful way to segue into, I got to look at the BenQ 3150R on TechThing this week. And this is, you know, their last ultra wide monitor did not get the most favorable reviews. but BenQ does some pretty amazing, they do some pretty amazing work for the money on the projector side of things. And I love ultra wide monitors. And this one, you know, 3440 by 1440, you know, a 35 inch panel. And I was kind of very curious to see what the performance was. I'm trying to pull up link because I want to verify something. But one of the things, they're doing some interesting stuff in terms of being able to monitor the light in the room, that I didn't get too much into the testing on that, because I mm-hmm. tend to find monitors that adjust themselves for my eyes great when I'm reading at 4 a.m. at home, but irritating if I'm doing any kind of production work. But, you know, they're not pushing this as a gaming monitor, despite the fact that it's got 100 hertz refresh rate and FreeSync built into it.
Sure.
You know, and it falls under what they call their video enjoyment line of monitors, which I just think is a fantastic name. But it made me realize how much I enjoy gaming at 100 hertz. And, you know, I didn't emphasize it enough in the review, but I really wish I had a FreeSync capable GPU to test this on, because, you know, running Rocket League at 144 hertz and 100 hertz monitor had me really noticing tearing in a way that I don't normally do so. But the kind of loose segue on this is, you know, it's a good looking monitor. It's a little more curved than I would want for, say, Photoshop work or stuff like that, because I think the super tight, it's got an 1800R radius, so that's a, you know, 3.6 meters
straight
circle.
Lines are important for that
straight, yeah. if you're straight lines in Word, you probably won't notice it after a couple of weeks, but I think in terms of engineering or Photoshop and stuff like that, I think you'll get a little agitated. But it's great for gaming because it gives you a very heavy curve that kind of, you know, by compared to a flat monitor, really keeps the edges at the details. But they're also claiming it's HDR capable. And it is, in terms of, like, it'll do that, but they've got, like, no published spec for the color gamut it's covering. And it's like 300 nits, which is great for a desktop monitor in an office. But it's not creating, you know, HDR-ish, you might notice something cooler when you put HDR content on it. But I feel like the whole HDR gaming desktop computer monitor thing is evolving and very, very, very early, because we're still in a lot of ways very, very early. It's a good-looking monitor.
I think the worry I have is that overuse of this term HDR on monitors like this that are not really HDR has the potential of watering down the desire and the market for real HDR, like cheap Walgreens VR headsets or 3D vision and 3D TVs and all this stuff, where it just, I worry that it gets oversaturated. People go, oh yeah, no, I've got an HDR. And they don't understand that if you get a real one, if you get a true HDR configuration, like you had one of those LG OLED TVs with HDR capability, that it is a dramatic difference. Yeah. And content. Yes. But it's a dramatic difference. It's close in relation to going from SD to HD, and ruining it by calling monitors that have a peak brightness of 300 nits HDR, I think, is beyond disingenuous at some point. But there's nobody monitoring it, so there's nothing to do about it other than to do reviews and us talk about it and say, hey, don't buy this one, buy this one.
Yeah. I mean, if you want HDR, this is not the monitor you want to buy. I want to say it was selling for, I think, $830 the last time I looked at it. So it's not an inexpensive monitor. But if you had an AMD GPU, I was like, it should probably be on your short list if you're looking for, or an AMD GPU capable of FreeSync, which I assume most are. Mm-hmm. It was very noticeable to me how much I was noticing tearing in a very significant way, in a way I haven't in a while. And I was like, oh,
yeah.
You know, I really risk it. I feel like I want to emphasize that on Tech Thing next week. But good looking monitor, bright enough for everyday use. I wouldn't consider it an HDR monitor in the true sense of the word, but a good looking piece of glass if you like the gaming. Speaking of FreeSync, this was kind of crazy. There have been a bunch of issues with firmware and getting that updated on Samsung's 2018 QLED TVs, and Ratings.com, who, by the way, they do fantastic fantastic reviews of televisions, and they're starting to do monitors. Yep. Robert's a big fan of their work. It's pretty crazy. Firmware update 1103 on their Samsung QLEDs they have in, quote, adds a FreeSync option in the game mode menu. We are currently testing it and certain should have results soon, which to me is really cool because gaming in a living room is really freaking awesome. And, you know, having, you know, variable refresh rate attached to your giant ass monitor in your giant ass monitor in your living room with your full surround sound system sounds particularly epic to me. So I just wanted to say that.
It's an interesting thing. I think we saw some more information come out today. I forget which website was reporting it, that there were, I think it was Digital Trends. They mentioned that Samsung, that there were two settings for it. There was like a standard and a more aggressive. Mm-hmm. The standard was like a variable refresh range of 90 to 120 at 1080p. And then the more aggressive one was like 48 to 120 at 1080p. So apparently it was only enabled at 1080p, not 4K. But it did support true 120 hertz input, which is obviously something that was a question previously. The 90 to 120 FreeSync range is an interesting, I don't know, it's an interesting thing because it's unlike anything we've ever seen before. And apparently either Samsung said or the release notes say or it says in the menu that when you go with the aggressive 48 to 120, there's a chance that there is brightness affected by it. And my assertion from reading that language is that there might be flickering that would occur in some instances if the mm-hmm. backlight on the TV isn't designed to, you know, run as low as 48 for that type of content. Again, I don't have one of these TVs. I'm trying to get one of these TVs to test out. But to caveats aside of how the implementation might work, I think this is a big potential win for AMD. If they can show, okay, look, we've got FreeSync displays out here of all these different specification classes, that we've got you know, the Xbox One supporting FreeSync. I'm just guessing that PlayStation will support it at some point as well. Now you can say you've got TVs out there that support it. Again, these Samsung TVs would be able to support it from a PC and or a gaming console. This is the ecosystem of FreeSync is starting to look more exciting than just what AMD was always touting before. It was like, oh, we've got 128 monitors that now support FreeSync. And I'm like, yeah, I don't really mm-hmm. care about the quantity. Tell me about the quality of these displays. But now if they can say we've got 96 monitors and now we've got 18 TVs and we've got all the game consoles, and now suddenly the FreeSync versus G-Sync debate is a very different topic to run down. Now it also has to work. It also has to be high quality. If I turn it on 48 to 120 and I see flickering on the screen, well, that's a failure on Samsung and AMD's part for getting this to work. So we'll have to see how that turns out, what the ratings guys come up with it as well. So it's only a handful of TVs. Looks like it's five different Samsung TVs from this year mm-hmm. so far. But the firmware is publicly available, and I'm kind of surprised I haven't seen a bunch of reports on this yet. A little disappointing that it doesn't support 4K resolution, apparently. But I think that might be more of an issue with getting above 60 hertz 4K, like the data connection. Like, keep mm-hmm. in mind that these are HDMI TVs. They don't have DisplayPort on them. So you'd have to go up to HDMI 2.1 if you wanted to get above 4K 60 anyway. So
good to know. NZXT announces H500 and H500i cases with tempered glass. You know, this seems to be sort of one of the primary aesthetics for the current sort of next generation of, or just, it just seems to be like, this is one of the, I don't know how to say this. You know, this is kind of the look, monochromatic, big glass windows, no hinges, rear sliding. So there's no big, latch inside of there. lots of exposure, lots of sort of unders. I hate to call this subtle, but I think it probably is actually subtle in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Steel box with glass window.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the design is clean. It doesn't have, you know, I've seen this with like Logitech keyboards recently. G910, which was my favorite keyboard, was very aggressive. A lot of angles and curves and RGBs and, you know, flashy gamer-esque logos. And now their their G513 that came out a couple of weeks ago is more svelte, a little bit thinner, brushed aluminum finish to the top, right? So same functionality, same capability, same key switches, but just a different design to it, right? A little bit heavier and weightier. And I think, yes, you are seeing that with some of these cases like the H500, H500i. This case also has something that I really love, and I don't know if other cases have done this yet. What do they call it? It is the water cooling installation is simplified using a removable bracket for either all-in-one CPU coolers or custom loop configurations. So basically that means the water cooler that you see on the front of the case in the picture, the bracket comes out, you attach the radiator to that, and then you kind of slide that bracket into place and it latches down, which is way more, which is way better than trying to hold it up to the right hole in the right angle while getting the screw in and then finding the screwdriver and trying to get it tightened. And it was always a pain in the neck, and you kind of always needed a third hand to do it. So any improvement in that regard would be nice. And to be fair, to be honest, I guess I would say innovation in cases is hard, right? Think of how long it took there to be a lot of innovation before Corsair kind of came in and said, you know what? Rubber grommeted holes to pass through cables behind everything. And then everybody did that. It became like, well, of course, why didn't we do this forever? And I think, you know.
Well, just rounding over case edges,
where we see it again.
I mean, how long has it been since? I have not reached into a case and come out bleeding, except on a case that's more than 5 years old, it seems like. I'm sure I could find a crappily made case with sharp edges.
Sure.
We had a great question for a viewer we're going to talk about next week where they're like, how do I buy a new CPU case? I'm like, well, you know, looks, you know, how many hard drives do you need? Do you need optical? How big a case do you need? You know, because it occurs to me that not a lot of people have a Fry's or a central computer or a micro center or, you know, much less a mom and pop computer shop that has, you know, I mean, we're lucky we've got Fry's. They usually have 30, 40 cases in stock at any time. But I got to say, one, I love your reviews. And two, that H500, that sells for $70. That's a really nice case for $70. The H500i, which adds the lighting and the fan control inside of there, that's $100. But, you know, that's a nice looking case for $70 there, kids. It's in blue and red and black and white, you know, so there's options for you to build your battle station and have the appropriate accents inside of your computer case. Cause yo, you roll like that, but, $70 for that. That's really nice. It's exciting. I like nice things that are affordable. They make me happy. Oh my goodness. One last thing before we go, I just wanted to say Nightjar, which is not a minor character in the Marvel X-Men universe, nor is it a euphemism for something you go potty in the 19th century in your bedroom. It's a new fanless power supply from Silverstone. And I apologize to anyone at Silverstone if I have just offended them, but the NJ450SXL, I'm a big fan of fanless power supplies, mostly because A, I've never owned one, and B, the idea of not having a fan in my power supply means my room is that much quieter. 450 watt power supply, 80 plus platinum. So you're talking about 92% efficiency, 100% load. Tim's got the write-up up on pcper.com. Silverstone claims this is, quote, the first SFX-L fanless PSU with an extruded aluminum outer shell with aluminum fins running front to back on the top, bottom, left, and right sides for maximum surface and cooling effort. My emphasis on cooling effort there at the end. Seems like it's pretty healthy in the terms of its 3.35 pounds. Fully modular cables, which is nice. 100,000 hours. Mean time between failure at 25 degrees Celsius. Unfortunately, quote, It is not clear from its website what the pricing, availability, or warranty length will be. Warranty at least 1 year, but it may be longer. And the warranty page for the extended years eligible products just hasn't been updated. You know, this looks like it's going to be expensive and have a less than enthralling warranty. And it's, I was asking, a friend of mine was asking about a power supply. I'm like, don't get a power supply that has less than an 8 year warranty. And they were like, why? And I'm like, because why would you save $20 with something with inferior components that's not going to have as long a life? I like the style. A little terrified of what the pricing on it's going to be. So, anything brewing outside of your search for a 1050 3 gigabyte GPU for testing? To see exactly what the memory bandwidth does. Is there anything you guys can tease that you're looking at PC per?
I mean, let's see. I'm actively trying to get a hold of one of these Acer or Asus HDR G-Sync monitors prior to their release next month. So far, no dice on that. We have in some giant servers, some Epic and some Xeon-based servers that the biggest hurdle on testing these is getting enough memory in, without spending a ton of money. As it turns out, if you have a two-socket Epic platform, you need 16 DIMMs just to have one, just to populate all of the channels in the system.
I'm just going to cough my head off here. That's prohibitively expensive.
Yeah, as it turns out. And then we had memory with our Intel server, but it only has 12 DIMMs in it. So now do we want to like double up and try to buy? I don't know. It's just one of those things. And it, with as expensive as it is, nobody's jumping up in line to share or sample 16 gigabyte DIMMs or 16 8 gigabyte DIMMs in order for us to populate that stuff. So that's an always interesting dilemma.
Like, where's that camel page? What's that? It's 16. No, that's 2x8. That's 1x16. 190. Just in case you're wondering, that's 16 times $196, which equals $3,136 before tax.
Yeah, and that was 8 gig modules, you said, right?
No, that was a single 16 gigabyte stick.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's 256 gigabytes of memory at least. So at least it's impressive sounding.
I mean, I can get you into, 2x8 for $165, which,
All right.
You only need 8 of those. So what's 8 times 164? Slightly less.
1320. Yeah, that sounds more reasonable for us, but we'll have to see what our workloads are going to be for the testing and evaluation.
You only have 128 gigabytes of RAM.
Yeah, only. I know, which is hardly any.
Well, we're laughing here, but it's on one hand, it's hardly any. On the other hand, you don't want to have an entire industry be like, those are really cool tests, but none of us would ever put less than X amount of RAM in a system. Go back to your drawing board, kid.
Correct. I mean, it wasn't. If you remember when the X299 chipset launched, we were talking about putting 64 gigs of memory in a high-end desktop system, right? That wasn't that long ago. Now memory prices have gone way up, and not only a crazy person would do that, but double that for a two-socket server platform, and yeah, you're not really enough. There's a reason why they talk about supporting 1.5 terabytes of memory per socket, I believe, on these. So worth noting.
Oh, my goodness. We wait, ladies and gentlemen, with bated breath to see how Mr. Ryan Shrout and PC Purr will solve the case of the high-class memory problem. Or the case of the, oh, my God, this is going to be an expensive build to do this review problem. Be more accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hate it when that happens. Our problems are not so exciting at Tech Thing, but there is lots going on. Shannon's waiting on her OnePlus 6. We got a review of that coming up. We talked about the Neurophone headphones. Somebody had actually asked about them on Twitter. So I got them in. They're wireless Bluetooth and have a very unusual design in the sense that it looks like it's a combination of an earbud inside of a headphone. That's not even the wildest thing it does. We'll be talking about those in the near future. Windows 10 pins, which are actually Windows 10 pin numbers, which are actually much more secure than you might think they are. And we'll be talking about finding a new PC case, because apparently I'm obsessed with new PC cases. And I think I figured out what I'm going to do with that new Mini ITX case that I got in. But we'll talk about that on another episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, which, ladies and gentlemen, you can find at twit.tv/twitch. I was trying to say twitch.tv/twit, which would not work. Twit.tv/twitch is the place to find all of our older episodes, and of course how to subscribe and links to the things that Ryan Shrout and I do. You can find him at pcper.com. You can find me at tekthing.com and at AVXL. If you're into home theater and audio, definitely check out AVXL. And yeah, thank you, each and every one of you, for listening or watching. And you can tweet at Ryan Shroud or at Patrick Norton if you have a question about hardware. And we welcome you to send those, because we always need more ideas to explore, whether it's for PC Per or the PC Per mailbag or tech thing. Or, of course, ladies and gentlemen, Twitch, which is the hardware podcast we hope you rely upon for useful information as things get crazier in the world of hardware. For example, new 1050 cards showing up quietly, just slipping into the market. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
Catch you next week on Twitch.